This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Hello and welcome to Newsmakers. I'm your host, Lisa Pugh. Congressman Mark Pocan of Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District is back home in Wisconsin on August recess from his work in D.C. He returns in just a few weeks to negotiations to prevent a looming government shutdown. He's been criticizing his GOP colleagues for recent decisions he's called extreme and dangerous. He joins Newsmakers today to talk about the state of Congress, 2024 elections, the economy, and more. Welcome, Congressman Mark Pocan.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Glad to be here.
How's it been being back in Wisconsin this summer?
Great. You know, this is always a period you can get around the district. You can see people. Generally, I'm out in Washington 3 of the 4 weeks, it seems like, is roughly the schedule. So you don't have much time back home during the week anyway. I get home pretty much every weekend. So having a whole month plus to do this, it really allows you to get caught up on a lot of things.
Best time of year to be here, right?
Absolutely.
So when you return to D.C., you'll have just a few weeks before that September 30th deadline when there's a potential government shutdown. I know you serve on the Appropriations Committee that's been moving some spending bills that need to be passed by Congress by that deadline. How concerned are you about a potential government shutdown?
Very. You know, watching the appropriations process, there's an old saying that there's Democrats, Republicans, and appropriators. And, you know, I'm not on a committee where you go to work every day to spit on your, you know, opposing party. Some committees are. They're there to fight, right? You see that happen on oversight and government reform and judiciary, but you don't on appropriations. It's kind of like our joint committee on finance that I used to work on when I was in the legislature. We have the one set of bills that has to pass. You know, nothing else has to get through Congress, but you have to pass a budget bill. And traditionally, that's kept Democrats and Republicans. You can disagree on some policy matters, but we always move the bills forward in a responsible way. Have a different version from the House and Senate. There's a reconciliation.
And that hasn't been happening this time?
Not at all. In fact, the Senate, we often like to jointly, but in a bipartisan way, make fun of when we're in the House because they're slow at doing this. They've passed all 12 of their bills.
In the Senate side?
On the Senate side with big bipartisan margins, like 23-3, you know, things like that. On the House side, it's completely different. So, you know, in order for Kevin McCarthy to become Speaker, he had to give away a lot. And some of that was putting some of the what I call crazies, onto the committee. So some of these fringe members of the Republican caucus, but because he has a 5-seat majority and it took him 15 ballots to become Speaker, he gave away the store.
So the nature, you feel like the nature of that committee is different because of its membership?
Absolutely. Some of the traditional folks that have been on there for a long time have been quiet as mice on the committee because they're not the ones in charge. And it's the folks that are those extreme members that are the ones that are making us violate the agreement. There was an agreement around the debt ceiling, you remember, that happened? Within 2 weeks,
June.
They gave up on the agreement, Republicans, and they started marking all bills to 22 spending levels. And then they still couldn't get those off the floor, they thought. So they added all these policy riders that have nothing to do with spending, which is appropriations, around pride flags, around abortion, around diversity, equity, inclusion, and all this extreme stuff. So most of our debates were centered around that because we had irresponsible funding levels for programs, and then they put on all these riders. At the end of the day, they still can't get them done. They've gotten one bill through all of Congress and 10 through committees, and we don't think that they're going to be able to get this done by the end of our fiscal year on September
30th. Well, the members of the Freedom Caucus say Americans shouldn't be worried about a government shutdown. They say that most Americans won't even notice that parts of government have shut down, and they say from their perspective, it's necessary to go to that line because we need to get spending under control. What's your reaction to that?
That's how crazy current thinking is in Congress, right? We had a debt ceiling agreement that would have made sure all of this went smoothly, and they violated it within 2 weeks. And then to say it's okay to shut down the government, to close down national parks, to maybe stop the mailing of Social Security checks, everything else. I mean, that's...
So Americans will see the impact.
You will see it, and you'll see it in steps, but you're closing down government. I mean, just think about it. If you didn't have a federal government, technically, we will still make sure some things get funded, like the military for defense. But other things, there will be an impact. We see it in 24 hours. Some people will, some people won't. But certainly down the road, you will. But it's still irresponsible. We have one job that we have to get done, is get either the 12 appropriation bills done or one big omnibus bill done, which is, you know, happened a lot in the last 12 years. But our fiscal year is September 30th. And if we don't do that, you either have to pass a short-term continuing resolution to give us more time.
Is that likely that will happen?
I hope so, because we're going to have to do something. But I think the more likely answer is there's going to be a government shutdown, because some of these
folks, we don't know
folks,
how long it will be.
They just want to do it. They want the T-shirt that says, I went to Washington and I shut down government, rather than what does it actually their job mean, which it's irresponsible to shut down the government. I mean, we have a job and they're not doing it.
You know, you mentioned the changing nature of that Appropriations Committee, and you were part of a heated exchange a while ago where you ended up calling your GOP colleagues bigots. It's a really strong term. Do you regret that? Do you mean that? Would you say it again?
Well, when every single appropriation bill, they added riders to talk about abortion. Somehow you have abortion in the bill that covers financial services, banning pride flags in the agriculture bill. It makes no sense, but they put that in there. Going after diversity, equity, inclusion, they defunded entirely moving forward with the National Hispanic Museum. I mean, there's only one answer to that. They weren't doing any policy around things that actually would be in appropriations, but everything was going after women, people of color, LGBTQ plus community. And what other term is there for it, right? I mean, that's the problem. So it was sad. And unfortunately, a lot of my colleagues came back to me and they were so happy to hear someone just say it. I've been doing this for a long time.
Colleagues on the other side of the aisle, even?
My side of the aisle. Although I'm sure if I talked to some of the others individually, they do have the frustration. I can tell you that, because they can't get anything done. I mean, I watch one senior member of Appropriations, and I won't say their name. I have a lot of respect for them. I've worked with them for years, and I think they're, you know, I can disagree, but we'll still get something done at the end of the day, which is the way it's supposed to be. I think he spoke twice in eight bills, because he's been so marginalized by these other folks that just got onto the committee that don't even know the process. And that's what's sad, right? Because you want to see it work. That's the one thing the public expects of both parties, is that we can do something together. And they think a government shutdown is fine.
I guess we'll see what happens in September. You mentioned defense spending. Mm-hmm. I know you're co-chair of the Defense Spending Reduction Caucus. Mm-hmm. You proposed a $100 billion cut to defense spending just today, which is Friday. The president has requested additional funding for efforts in Ukraine, I think $24 billion. Is it with troops in Ukraine, with increased threats? How does that $100 billion cut sit with what we need to have happen?
Sure. So every time we've funded Ukraine, we're doing this through a supplemental. So that is what the president asked for. And we've been supportive of the funding for Ukraine, because clearly a country invaded another country and you can't have that. And Ukraine has been an ally to the United States, and Russia has proven in many ways they're not. What we're saying is every agency has to pass audits in order to show they're fiscally sound, except for defense. You've got nearly $1 trillion annually being spent. And we're up to almost that level now with defense. Five audits, they failed. The last audit, they could only account for 39% of their equipment. I mean, no one would accept that in any other agency. And yet what's happened is the defense budget has become a jobs program. Every single district has companies that get money from the defense. We have military contractors make all sorts of things. There's a company in my district that comes to me every year and wants me to buy more submarines than the Department of Defense asked for. And they make,
you think that's irresponsible?
Well, they make a part as big as my pinky that goes on a submarine, and they want me to buy an entire new submarine because of it. But it's become a jobs program, so people hear about it from their district. So we don't really ever have any checks and balances. There's more money, more money.
You're proposing a $100 billion cut. What kind of a message do you think that sends to our NATO allies? I mean, is that, and it's not an insignificant amount of money that you're proposing should be cut?
Oh, but we spend so much more than almost, than dozens of our NATO allies and other allies combined, right, already on defense. The problem is you have fewer and fewer defense contractors. So the bidding process has gotten worse and worse. I mean, all the stories about the expensive toilets and hammers. I'll give you just one example. The most recent class of aircraft carrier, the Ford-class aircraft carrier, has a bit of a design flaw that when the toilets get clogged, you have to flush $400,000 worth of acids down the toilet to make them flush again. Literally flushing money down the toilet. I can't think of a better example than that. But, you know, we spent billions of dollars on an amphibious vehicle that only sinks. And we tried it over and over and over, and there's no accountability to this. And yet the defense contractors get enriched. This isn't money for our troops. We all want to fund the troops. In fact, we said that money can't come from troops. But this is going to often no bid or single bid contracts. And that's why we get those awful deals. And then there's no ability to audit it. That is an issue, actually, that we have Democrats and Republicans working together to try to move forward. Yeah. The problem is there's also Democrats and Republicans working against us, because if they have a big presence of defense contractors in their district, it suddenly becomes a jobs issue.
You know, moving on, in addition to the spending bills that need to pass, the Farm Bill is up for reauthorization and has a September deadline. What's at stake for Wisconsin in the Farm Bill?
A lot. Our farmers, you know, we have to get this done. I'm serving on a special task force that our leader, Hakeem Jeffries, has put together, and I'm representing the Upper Midwest on that task force. And our concern is that it should be done by September 30th, right? Because otherwise some things aren't authorized. So it better be done very quickly thereafter if we don't have it done by September 30th. But trying to do all these appropriation bills could be difficult at the same time. But, you know, everything from crop insurance to marketing program dollars to so many things that affect so many people in our state, it's really important to have this done. And this shouldn't
be bipartisan support.
Well, it should be. It always has been. But if they start putting riders in about flags and abortion and everything else, suddenly they're making a bill ridiculous, right?
That's what you're expecting.
And that's what, unfortunately, we're expecting. Congress has become ridiculous a bit.
So moving on to the economy, what's working and what isn't working in the national economy?
A lot is working right now, actually. I mean, it was tough. I'm a small business owner. There's no question COVID was tough on just about everybody. And we're out of that. And because as we came out of that, everything opened at once around the globe. We had hyperinflation around the globe, not just the United States, all over. And people felt that, and prices were going up. And the good news is jobs are still being created, even with all the efforts to lower inflation, which is now working, and we're seeing inflation come down. There are still jobs for people. We don't have any issues there. Pay has gone up along with the inflationary process. So there's a lot of good things happening. And we passed four big bills last session from the American Rescue Plan that helped get us out of COVID. The infrastructure bill, four presidents, Democrat and Republicans, talked about it. One got it done, Joe Biden and the Democrats in the last session. We passed the Chips and Science Act to start making more computer chips here. We only made, I think it was 12 or 14% of the chips we use in this country. And through COVID, we saw that could be a problem. Average vehicle has 1,000 chips, average electric vehicle, 2,000 chips. So, you know, that was important to start making things here. And that leveraged $40 billion in construction, which is, again, good family supporting jobs. And then finally, we passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which is lowering the cost of healthcare and energy costs. So we had four giant bills that you're going to see effects for the next decade continue to happen. So I think the positive sides are jobs are absolutely there. Pay is up. Inflation is coming down. But, you know, we still are feeling a little bit of that hangover from coming out of COVID. And people certainly have a right to be concerned.
You've tweeted about your support for Biden economics. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, Thursday, the latest CPI numbers came out, an increase of 3.2% in July over the last year. You said inflation is cooling, but consumers, Americans, have paid the price over the last several years with increased gas prices, food prices, other products. Do you consider, in light of that, President Biden has been a strong leader on the economy?
He didn't create inflation around the globe, and that's where we have it. Every single country has inflation coming out of COVID. In fact, our inflation is one of the few that's coming down right now. I just saw in England, they just raised their interest rate yet again, I think for the eighth time or something, because they're still having a much higher rate. We fortunately got our hands on it a little better. We're going to come out of this a little quicker.
And you give the president credit for that.
Absolutely. You know, and many of the measures we did in the Inflation Reduction Act and other bills have helped to get us there, as well as the Fed in doing some of what they did. Although I think they can stop on the interest rate increases. As a small business owner, I think at some point, you know, when their measure is when you stop creating jobs, I don't think that's a good measure. I think this is a once in a century inflation coming out of a global pandemic. And because of that, maybe the normal ways we measure things are different. And I think, you know, and I've tried to say that to folks as well, because I want them to understand that, you know, I think if you raise interest rates too much, small business owners aren't able to buy new equipment so they can hire more people. And then
there's
a
sweet spot.
And then you can, yeah, have a bad point where you start to have a recession. The good news is it looks like we're not going to have that recession. I mean, because the growth is so phenomenal that, and it's going to last for a while because a lot of these.
Well, you know, you talk about good news, you talk about growth. It doesn't necessarily seem like voters are getting that message. The recent Marquette University poll kind of shows that that voters are still skeptical about the governor's, or I'm sorry, the president's job approval. The president's job approval rating still low, despite inching up slightly to 42% from 39% in May. Disapproval in July was 57%, down from 61% in May. In national polls from earlier this year, President Biden tied for the second lowest approval rating of any president in the last 70 years. Why do you think that the polls are not reflecting more optimism and support for the governor's job or the president's job?
No worries. Well, and part of it is I think we have to tell our stories better, right, about what we got done, because we are coming out of this better than many other countries around the planet. And a lot of that was due to measures that we did in Congress and the president got done. So that's important. But there's a lot of stories to tell.
People aren't understanding it.
We have to tell more of it, trust me. I mean, you know, you have to repeat something so many times for people to really understand. The other thing is politics right now. No one is going to have high approvals for anything. We've become so polarized. Donald Trump came in, and the way the new politics is under Donald Trump is this kind of vicious sort of way we treat each other. Not how I remember when I was in the state legislature, certainly. You know, people like Robin Voss, the Republican speaker, and I are very good friends because we work together on things. You just don't see much of that.
So this doesn't surprise you, these lower approval ratings.
No, until politics changes as it is, we are such a polarized nation, no one will ever have really outstanding numbers.
We know in the upcoming presidential election that age will be part of the discussion. In November, the president turns 81. Former President Donald Trump is 77. Do you firmly believe that President Biden has the mental sharpness, the physical capacity to be president for another term?
Sure. I have to admit, I had a couple opportunities to be in the Oval Office, and I have to admit that was kind of a pinch-worthy time when the first time you're there. 10 members, we spent about 2.25 hours talking about his Build Back Better agenda. The entire time, he fielded every single question, with the exception of one, that he went to his staff on. And that was a very robust agenda. He knew it off the top of his head. So mentally, he's certainly there. I think anyone who's at their early 80s has got some fragility, and Donald Trump and he are 3.5 years apart, so there's not really a negligible difference between the two. Look, you know, do I think it is time that a next generation does eventually come in to do politics? We saw that with Barack Obama, and I think that was inspirational for many people. We just did that with the Democratic leadership in the House. Hakeem Jeffries is our Democratic leader. He would be the next speaker if we took the majority. He came in my class. He's a good friend. You know, I would love to see and be around for when we
But you don't have concerns about the age of president?
Not at all, based on any mental performance of job. You know, would I want to put him in a running contest against Justin Trudeau? No, but neither one of those I'd want to do that. But it's just, you know, it's where we are. Those are the two people that look like they're going to be the nominees right now. And they're only 3.5 years different. It's not really a significant difference with either one.
You know, looking forward to that election next year, there has been record smashing out of state spending on our elections. What kind of impact do you think that has on the influence of regular Wisconsin voters in our elections?
Yeah, it depends how it's being spent. I mean, I was heartened to see the Republican Party in Wisconsin do something. They were the first state to do it with a new Republican initiative of embracing early voting, because we've had that and everyone should. The more people that vote, if our turnout is the highest in the country, and we used to be second or third highest in the country, that's something we should be proud of.
Because, and so out of state spending on that is okay?
If it's about getting people out to vote so that they can participate and have their voice heard, I don't have a problem. If it's to distort records and put misinformation out, to often, a lot of it is spent to make you not want to vote, right? And that's the problem I have, when you want to put lies out there so people go, oh, they're all alike, I don't want to vote.
Is that true on both sides?
Yes, although I would argue one side does it significantly more than the other. You know, Donald Trump seems to embrace big lies rather, you know, passionately, and that's a problem. But, you know, but seeing the Republican Party in Wisconsin say, let's do more early voting, that's good. Like, if we could come out of here and be the number one state for voter turnout, whatever result we have is stronger because of it. And I think that's positive. So I don't...
You're mixed on out-of-state spending.
I would go to... honestly, if I had the magic wand, so to speak, I would have public financing of elections, because that way you take all big money out, period, and you would have, I think, a much more fair process. But I'm not the person in charge, so we're seeing money escalate and escalate, and that's not necessarily good. But if it is spent strictly to get people out to vote, I don't have as much problem. But when it's the lies and distortions and trying to convince people not to get out to vote or to put misinformation out, then that's very egregious.
You referenced a prediction that former President Trump, President Biden will be the nominees for their parties next year. The Marquette poll does show that former President Donald Trump has increased his support among Republicans for the nomination. He leads second place candidate Florida Governor Ron DeSantis by some 24 percentage points nationally. When matched up with President Biden in a hypothetical 2024 race, the two are evenly split, with each candidate receiving 50% support. We know former President Trump is facing his third indictment. Shouldn't those poll numbers be reflecting a greater poll for President Biden because of that?
In traditional politics, how we've always done things, yes, because facts mattered. What's amazed me is Donald Trump, because he does embrace so many lies. January 6th, just as an example, we all saw it with our eyes. Now, you don't got to call it an insurrection. You might call it a mob. You might, you know, there's different terminology. But it wasn't what Ron Johnson said, which was, it was another tourist day at the Capitol, right? We all saw that. I saw it from the seventh floor of the Longworth building, thousands of people on each side of the Capitol breaking in and trying to break in on each side.
Why isn't that not reflected in more support for President Biden?
And that's the part, is Donald Trump has convinced people, they see it with their own eyes, and yet they're going, well, no, it wasn't an insurrection. Nothing really happened that day. Because politics is so divided. So they're sticking with their team, so to speak, team blue, team red. But that defies how things used to work. I mean, if you could see it with your own eyes, you should then, if someone says, you know, if I told you this is an orange and clearly it's not, you know, people would say, no, it's not. And they would be able to make a logical decision based on that. These days, the way politics is, if one party says that's an orange and the other party says that's a chocolate bar, there'll be 45% of the people thinks it's an orange, 45% a chocolate bar, and not that many people say it's a white cup of water. And that's the sad part, I guess, I have from doing this as long as I have, is that I want to get back to a place where we can have some disagreements based on ideology, but at the end of the day, we get something done. We know there's compromise to get things done, but you don't treat people so awfully. You don't make it such a blood sport that it's really become. I'm hoping that day will come someday again. I think when Donald Trump is gone, there's a good chance it will. But I've seen a lot of good people leave the Republican Party because they're also pushed out by their own party right now. And that concerns me.
You know, Republicans have been critical of the Department of Justice's handling of the Trump indictment. They say more attention should be put on Hunter Biden and the investigation into the president's son and the president's potential involvement in international influence peddling. Today, we know that the attorney general appointed a special counsel in the Hunter Biden case. Doesn't that mean that Hunter Biden investigation deserves more attention and scrutiny?
But one is around a former president on things like trying to not give up power as president. And what is about a guy who may have had tax evasion? If he did, he should be prosecuted under the law.
International dealings that...
But that's not actually any of the allegations that aren't the political allegations. What they're saying is he didn't pay taxes and he had a gun charge. And unless other things come out, that's right now what it is. He should pay the price for that. And if people thought that deal wasn't strong enough, that's fine. Now they're going to have more investigation. But only the innuendo implies the president and all the rest.
You say there aren't facts on that. Is that what you're
absolutely
saying?
Absolutely. Yeah. But you know what? If they're bringing up the level of the investigation, I have no problem with that. Anyone who breaks the law should have to pay the price. But to say that they're the same is certainly more of a political statement than a factual one.
You know, Wisconsin had 10 Republicans that were referenced in that indictment document, along with a total of 84 individuals in 7 states. You wrote a letter about a year ago, January, to the attorney general about those 10 individuals. Mm-hmm. The governor has recently said they should be charged. What do you think should happen to those 10 individuals?
Yeah, they should be charged.
Criminally charged?
I believe if it turns out that it is a criminal, like it was done with intent and everything, which we believe It is, but again, let's wait till there's a trial to actually say that. Yeah, you should be held accountable. But I mean, let's think about what happened. Again, I can't think of it in my lifetime where you had people pretend that someone else won, pretend to be electors. They had information knowing that they were doing this as like a separate process. We had a senator who
they were doing it to preserve a legal strategy that they did not give permission
for.
That's
not legal. It's called an illegal strategy. That's the problem. And if it's illegal, they should be held accountable. So it really is as simple as that. We're not saying if they didn't do anything illegal, they should be prosecuted. No, but if they did something illegal and it does appear to be illegal, then they should be prosecuted. Because if we don't, someone else will decide the next time to do that or something maybe worse. At the end of the day, the integrity of the vote really has to be preserved and everyone has to respect it. Like I think we have most of my lifetime, but it has changed right now. And that's why
those 10 people should face charges and further investigation.
And I'm glad that the Attorney General did go after states where they're looking at this scheme to do fake electors.
As I'm sure you know, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has been asked to weigh in on legislative redistricting, but they're only looking at the state legislative maps. They're not looking at congressional districts. Is that a mistake? Do you think they should?
It'll depend what lawsuits. I think there could be more lawsuits coming yet on this, because let's face it, we're a purple state. In fact, we're so purple that, you know, the governor has won, what, twice by less than 1%. You know, we're very, very split. And we have two Democratic members of Congress and six Republican members. I mean, common sense and basic math show a problem. The legislature, clearly, we have some of the most gerrymandered state legislative maps in the country. So I hope that if the Supreme Court does look at this, they look at it very closely, because the problem is you had big change in the 2010 maps when they first took over the majority. And then they said, well, now least change is the new policy. So they barely changed it. Well, yeah, if you did big change 10 years ago, that was gerrymandering, and now you barely change it. The reality is it's that you have to go back to the 2010.
You expect new state legislative maps in place by the March 2024 election?
I am not an attorney and I'm not on the Supreme Court, but I would certainly, I know that they are some of the most gerrymandered maps in the country. And if the court says that as well, hopefully we'll have maps. And again, it's just fair. You should be able to run for office, let the voters decide. You don't pick your constituents, they pick their elected officials.
So we've been talking about some heavy issues. I've been putting you on the spot here. So we're going to do something a little fun. Are you up for some word association
sure.
to kind of round out our interview?
Okay. All right.
I'm going to say a word or a term or a name, okay. and I want you to say the first word that pops in your mind.
All right.
Okay. This is not a magic trick.
Okay.
Donald Trump.
Criminal.
Joe Biden.
President.
Wisconsin Summers.
Awesome.
Second Congressional District.
Also awesome. Awesome, one word.
Bipartisanship.
Forgotten.
Well, a final question to round out our conversation. What are you planning to do with the rest of your time on August recess?
Getting around the district for a couple weeks. I'm also going on a congressional delegation at the end of the month to Nepal, dealing with child labor, forced labor, and child marriage. So kind of deep subjects, it's important that members of Congress do use their positions to go around the globe, and often because we do provide funding in a lot of places around the planet. This allows us some ability to see things and try to help in conditions that maybe aren't the best conditions in this country. I believe this might be the first delegation they've done around this issue. So a lot of people are working in almost like slave-like sort of conditions in the Middle East on construction from Nepal. A lot of children are able to work. So we're going to border checkpoints and a number of things. So.
And then back to D.C. for more.
One more week here then after that, and then back to D.C., trying to get all the stuff done from the farm bill to those other 11 budget bills.
Spending bills. Mm-hmm.
We also have to then take up the reconciliation of some sort of national defense bill, because you had very different bills between the House and the Senate. Lots to do.
It's going to be busy.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for taking time out to join us
sure.
today.
Thank you.
And just a reminder to our viewers, we strive for balance in our programs. We're going to be inviting Congressman Mark Brian Stile to join us in September, so we hope you will watch. And thank you, as always, to our viewers of Newsmakers. Be sure to tune in again as we highlight the issues and sit down with the decision makers who make a difference for all of us.
This program is a production of Wisconsin Eye, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit media network with a mission to inform, educate, and engage the citizens of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Eye is the nation's first and only independently funded state civics broadcast network, providing gavel-to-gavel access to government proceedings and events at the state capitol.